Hello, and welcome to the Portland Art Museum podcast. I'm Brian Fariso, the director and chief curator of the museum. This episode is the audio from a conversation I had with Life Trustee, arts advocate, and philanthropist Arlene Schnitzer on November 5th, 2014, in association with the exhibition In Passionate Pursuit, the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Collection and Legacy. We are releasing this episode now because we recently lost Arlene, who passed away last week at the age of 91. Arlene Schnitzer, with her late husband Harold, provided unprecedented leadership and contributions at pivotal moments in the museum's history. Most recently, Arlene made a historic gift to the museum to help support the Connections campaign. In my conversation with Arlene, we talked to her about her close friend, the late Robert Colescott, whose work is currently hanging at the Portland Art Museum in an exhibition called Art and Race Matters, The Career of Robert Colescott. At the time of this episode's release, the museum is in the midst of a temporary closure in response to the global coronavirus pandemic, and our team is working hard to provide an online experience for this exhibition and others at the museum. Arlene attended a panel discussion with the exhibition's curators, Lowry Stove Sims and Matthew Wesley, as well as our very own Grace Cook Anderson, the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Northwest Art. A link to the video of that discussion can be found in this episode's description. And now, here is my conversation with Arlene Schnitzer. I'm Brian Fariso, the director. So nice to see everyone here this evening. And it's a great honor for me to interview Arlene Schnitzer. We're going to do this a little bit differently. And first, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little bit of a blurb about Arlene and Harold and a little bit of a talk about their history with the museum and with our city. So let me begin, and I'm not sure if everyone knows this, but Arlene began her relationship with this institution as a student at the Museum Art School in 1958. And her frequent visits to our galleries with her late husband, Harold, nurtured their relationship to what I believe is art, eventually leading to the founding of the Fountain Gallery in 1961. And I think many of you recall that gallery, and it's such a significant part of our history. Through the gallery, Arlene and Harold solidify their commitment to the artists of the Northwest and really initiated what I call an unprecedented art appreciation and collecting in our city and our state. And it's really served as the foundation for this community. Their passion for art also led to leadership roles at the museum, and both were appointed the first Life Trustees in 2007. After Arlene's appointment to the board in 1967, and Harold's in 1990, their joint service continued for more than 20 years for this museum. Today, Arlene continues to be a very active member of our executive committee. Thank you, Arlene. With donations of more than $10 million to the museum, Arlene and Harold are the largest single financial contributors to our museum in our history. Endowment gifts to the Northwest Art and Asian Art Departments total over $5.5 million, and capital investments exceed $3.6 million. Additionally, they have donated nearly $1 million in support of special exhibitions, membership, and general operations. At the heart, as many of you know, of our institution are our collections, and Harold and Arlene have built and sustained those collections as well as allowed them to evolve. Among the foremost collectors of Chinese Han Dynasty art in the world, they have gifted more than 70 unique objects to our museum, and they are appreciated worldwide. And for those of you who have not been to the Han Dynasty collection or galleries, it's something to be seen. It's one of the great unique aspects and one of the most important collections in this institution, thanks to Harold and Arlene. Their role as founders of the Fountain Gallery also facilitated recognition of much-deserved Northwest modernists and allowed them to build their Northwest collection. Many of the works you see in the exhibition, as well as in our wing, are the result of that commitment. Additionally, Harold and Arlene have contributed major pieces of American and English silver, as well as provided funds for the acquisition of major pieces. Now, what I thought was interesting when I've gotten to know Harold and Arlene is their influence upon others. And they have helped and I think inspired many in this community to become major collectors of Northwest art. And I'd like to just name a few of them, Dick and Deanne Rubenstein in particular, Lila and Doug Goodman, Katie Durant and Gordon Sondland, Jim and Susan Winkler, and Jerry Pratt, to name a few. And I'm sure all of us have been touched by Arlene and Harold's collecting or been inspired by the Fountain Gallery. But I think most significantly, and the biggest impact that they've had, is on their son, Jordan. And today, he's considered to be one of the world's foremost postmodernist war print collectors. And although his, and through his collection sharing, it's a very unique program where he shares his collection to museums throughout the country, he's really had a significant impact, not only on this institution, but many museums and a lot of university museums in particular, connecting with young students and educators about the great works of art in his collection. So a real nod to Jordan tonight. In all, I can say without a doubt that this institution has achieved an unparalleled success, due in large part to Harold and Arlene Schnitzer. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Arlene tonight to be with us to have a conversation. So Arlene, welcome. Now, as many of you know, Arlene has always a unique way of doing things. So we talked about this the other day. How would you like to do this? And she said, well, of course, Brian, we're going to ask the audience questions first. There's no questions and answers after. It's going to be first. So we're going to start the conversations with questions from you. Now, if you don't have questions, we have a lot of ideas in my mind that I could share with you and elicit some thoughts from Arlene. But let's start with some questions from the audience, and perhaps we can get going that way. So
let me just interject here for 1 minute. The reason I asked Brian to do that is because otherwise you just spend a lot of time talking about things that really your audience isn't interested in. So I thought this way, if we got questions first, why, at least it's at least one person's interested in something. So let's hear it.
And here's a question up front. Jim.
It's an astonishing collection, but what I'm curious about is what was the first piece? What did you start the collection with?
Wow. The first, honest to God, I don't know. Jordan knows the very first piece he bought, he wrote on the back. This was the beginning of the Jordan Schnitzer collection. I honestly, you know, we opened, my mother and a friend of ours, Edna Brigham, opened this little space down on 2nd and Ankeny. And, you know, every morning I had to push the homeless out of the doorway so we could open the door. And it was small. I had a little section set aside for prints. And do you know that I don't know the first thing I bought? I know that I became an addict. You know, one thing I want to say at the outset, because it's really important to me to say it at the beginning, is the truly unsung hero in this whole thing is Harold. You know, I get a lot of credit, but it was really Harold and my dad, Simon Director, who really supported us from the beginning. When my mother and I went to the bank, and this was 1961, my mother and I, to open the gallery, went to the bank to borrow $50,000. We couldn't do it unless we had Harold and my dad on the dotted line with their signatures. And for you women in the audience, I just wanted to mention that because I think that's kind of an interesting point. And they were both very supportive. They were more than willing to do it. But that's always, all these years, kind of rankled me. That so we did. We opened this little space on the corner of 2nd and Ankeny, and it was a really glorious experience. Mike Russo helped us hang the first show, and most of you know what the journey's been ever since.
Thank you. Other questions?
Hello. I have, do you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you.
I have sort of two questions. Well, one of them is, Jack Portland is my and my wife's favorite contemporary Oregon artist. And I was wondering why you did, he was not a part of the show this time. And then I assume he's part of your collection.
Thank you for asking about Jack. I was thinking about him this afternoon when I sat at my desk and was kind of thinking about what I wanted to say tonight. Jack was still in art school when I opened the gallery, and he and an artist by the name of Lenny Pitkin, who I'm sure a lot of you are also familiar with, they were always together. And I made a rule that I wasn't ever gonna take an artist into the gallery until they'd been out of art school at least a year plus, because I wanted to see what they were doing independently. I didn't want that influence so strongly felt like I had seen on so many students during that first year or so out of art school. So after about a year and a half went by after Jack and Lenny Pitkin graduated, who I think he's, Lenny I think is now teaching at Pacific Northwest College of Art. So they came to see me in the gallery because they wanted to have the work included. And I can remember walking over to them in the middle of the gallery and saying, first of all, you gotta quit this Bobbsey twin routine. And they looked at me and they said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, what if I like one of you and not the other? Then I'm gonna be more inclined to say no to both of you. So you've gotta walk into galleries, whether it's mine or anybody else's, and be independent and show your work independently of each other. Stop the Bobbsey twin stuff. So they did. I did end up taking both of them into the gallery. I think Jack is one of the most talented of that younger generation of artists. And is he still living part-time in Italy? Yes, and he's just done some beautiful, beautiful work. And he personally is a wonderful man. And I've watched him develop and grow ever since art school. And a talented, careful, really superb artist.
So Arlene, you have a great story in the book about how Jack got his name. I don't know if you want to share that.
Well, we were all sitting around one night. There was Jack and Lenny and I think Mike was there and several of the other artists, and they were talking about Robert Indiana and Judy Chicago, and somebody said, well, gee, Loftus, which was what Jack's name was, Jack Loftus, why don't you take the name Portland? And he says, okay. From that minute on, he became Jack Portland.
When you were purchasing each piece, there was a reason for it. And now looking at this whole collection, when you walk by your home and you see a particular piece or a group, is there something, one of those that just strikes an emotional chord or a memory that you look at, it's almost like your baby. Is there something that just really strikes an emotional note with you?
Well, maybe I was in a little different position than the average customer who walked into the gallery to purchase a painting, because it was my gallery. So I was committed, number one, to the artist that I opted to show in the gallery. And I used to say, you know, you don't have to have a space. I honestly was thinking about this the other day. I don't think I have bought any of our art thinking of a space. I bought some objects thinking, gee, that would look great on this table. But I don't think I've ever bought a painting and thought, gee, this is perfect for this space or this is perfect for that space. Now, listen, you know, I've had the luxury of having first crack, you might say, at a lot of the artist's work, and also the luxury, for which I'm grateful, of being able to buy a lot of art. But I don't buy for a spot. Do I alternate? Yes, I think it's very difficult. It's so easy to put something up and leave it there. But when you get to the point where you really walk by it and you don't see it, then it's time to retire it and rehang. And it's not easy to do, but think about everybody when you go home tonight how many times you've walked by something and you realize I didn't really see it. So you just have to sometimes pick out a day and get somebody in to help you rehang and just do it. And I think you should also, I used to say to people, you know, put something under the bed, but don't pass it up. when you feel something about a painting, when you see it, and it's like nothing else. And for all of you who I'm sure have something on your walls that's created by artists, take it down. And all of a sudden you think, oh my gosh, that space, what was there? I can't stand it.
When one has a portrait painted of themselves, who's in charge? Is it the subject themselves, or is it her spouse, or is it the artist? And I mean, who decides that there's a piano in the picture, and et cetera, et cetera?
That is really a great question. It depends on whether you're talking about boardroom portraiture or whether you're talking about a certain, this is the way I feel, or you're talking about a certain artist whose work you love and who does portraiture that you respect. If you want something that is such, this is the way I feel, if you want something that is such a likeness of you, then go have a wonderful photograph made. But when you're having a portrait done, you're asking that artist and his interpretation of what you look like to him. So that's just the way I happen to feel personally, but other people, when they have portraits done, they want it to be a likeness. And let me just tell you a quick little story. Jordan commissioned, when he was young, I think he was about 12. He was about 8 when I opened the gallery, and I think he was about 12 at the time. And Sally Haley was very well known for portraits in the city, and I'm sure many of you even maybe have portraits done by her. And he commissioned her to do a portrait of his grandparents, my mother and dad. And she did a portrait of my mother, and my mother was a small woman, and she had white hair, and she was a formal person. I mean, people who'd worked for her for 30 years still called her Mrs. D. They didn't call her by her first name, but she was quite just steady, a steady person. And Sally painted her very regal with these folds and folds of purple material around her and almost like she was Queen Elizabeth. And Jordan came in, who was a little kid, and he said, "Sally, that's not my grandmother." And she destroyed the painting. So that kind of, I'm telling you, it was a very personal story, but I'm kind of telling it to you as an example of how an artist feels about a commission or their painting, or if you've asked them to do something, are you asking for a likeness? As I said, then they will tell you, go get a photograph. If you're asking for their interpretation, then you accept what they see.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's, you know, there's the Hank Pender portrait, which is featured in the exhibition. We actually have an image we'll show in a bit. But I think that issue really emerges, because I think you and Harold weren't sure how you felt about it at first.
Harold was very sure. He and Jordan did not like that Hank Pender portrait of me.
Okay.
I, who philosophically felt exactly like what I just said to you, was very accepting of it. That is what he saw at that moment. So I'm thrilled to have it. It was a moment in time in my history.
It's very well done. Yes, any other questions?
Ryan, hi Arlene. Let me preface my question quite quickly. Several years ago in Miami Beach, a small sculpture was found in a retirement home, abandoned basically in the corner, and they interviewed the residents of the retirement home and they said, "Oh, that ugly, awful thing." It was a Giacometti.
It was a what?
It was a Giacometti. Last night in New York at Sotheby's, a record was set for sculpture, $100 million for the sister of this piece in Miami Beach. What gives a piece value?
I wonder every time I look in the paper and see that the Bacon just went for $42 million or the Warhol just went for, honest to God, I wish I were an economist. I don't know the answer to that. What do you think? Why do you think? I've got some thoughts, but let me hear what you think.
I was always raised that if no one wanted it, it had no value. But I don't totally believe that. I believe in inherent beauty.
Are we spoiled out here in the Northwest? Our prices are so low compared to, I think, frankly, I'd put our artists out here up against anybody anywhere. I always felt that. Not 100% of them, but a lot of them. And here, I mean, the same painting that was $450 would be $28,000 somewhere else. I remember I brought a show every couple of years out here from Arnie Glimcher at Pace Gallery, Leo Castelli at Castelli, and Nate Kolodner from Andre Emmerich Gallery. They were nice enough to combine their shipping to help me out because it was coming to the other side of the country. And I had a Hans Hoffman from Arnie Glimcher from Pace Gallery sitting in my office, and I was kind of working with it and looking at it, and it was $25,000, which at that time here in Portland in the gallery was a big price. And I had it kind of sitting on the floor leaning against the wall because I was kind of working with it and thinking, you know, I'm trying to understand this. And right then, coincidentally, I get a phone call. And he said to me, "You got that Hans Hoffman on consignment from me?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you have to put it up to $45,000. And I said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I've already shown it to a couple of potential people for $25,000. He says, "Doesn't matter." They didn't answer right then. It's $45,000. I don't understand. I didn't understand intrinsically what made the difference right at that moment, except the market, that somebody came into the gallery and was willing to pay X for Warhol and X for, I mean, I don't get it myself.
How would you feel about a show that's totally unlabeled, where all we saw was the piece, we had no idea of who made it or the value or the provenance?
How would I feel about a show with no price tags on it?
Or no,
well, where the emphasis was just put directly on the piece without any, you know.
Well, I think there are a lot of those. I mean, I think you go into a gallery and most galleries don't put prices on the wall because that's the way that they have of forcing you to ask them how much is this so they can start a conversation with you. I didn't believe in that. I always put prices up because I happen to like prices when I go somewhere. But it's a very tough business. Let me tell you all, it is a hard business. Harold used to say to me, you've got a high-strung temperamental group of people supplying you your product, and you've got a high-strung temperamental group of people over here buying your product. You know, it's a very tough business. The artists are constantly needing money. They're constantly after their dealers because they need the money. They're not frivolous in their requests. And they've chosen a lifestyle that is not always sufficiently rewarding monetarily. And it's tough to be an artist. It's tough to be a gallery, a dealer, and unless you make it big in the big time, unless you have paintings that are in the, you know, $50,000 bracket and up, then they're making a, you know, if you're talking about, even if they make 10 or 15%, they've paid for their electricity for the day. But in parts of the country like this, and I'm sure lots of other cities throughout the country, that they're trying to really support their artists and keep their artists working in their cities, because that, to me, is the soul of a city. Just imagine this community without art departments and without artists working, without galleries to go to, and walking into all the offices and the buildings that we do, and just absolutely blank walls. Just visualize that for a sec. There's no soul. But it's a tough business to be a dealer, I'm telling you. I did it for 25 years. It's tough to be an artist and to put those things on the wall that you've labored over for a couple of years, and you're exposing your heart and your soul, and you have people come in and just, there's nothing worse than indifference. Mm-hmm. I used to say to somebody, tell me you hate it, but don't be indifferent. There's nothing worse than indifference. Don't just walk by it, give it a chance. And we've hung an awful lot of art in our offices, and I've said the same thing. I've had employees say, oh my God, I'm not gonna live with that, take it down. And I've said, give me 3 months. If you still want me to take it down after 3 months, I will. Try to get it away after 3 months. So, answered your question, but rambled, I'm sorry.
Well, I think the simplest explanation has always been what someone's willing to pay for it. So, I think there was a question over here. Yes.
I'm just wondering, criteria, you had said earlier that you did not select anything based on a particular spot that you wanted to fill, but was it emotional, or was it, certain criteria that you had when selecting the works that you did?
I'm glad you re-asked that question. Thank you. Having the gallery, I had the luxury of feeling that way, but all of a sudden I'm remembering going to people's homes because they came to pick out a painting for over a credenza or over a couch. And yes, you have to do that. You're filling up your wall. And so really what I said wasn't maybe accurate or fair. You do walk in and look for a certain painting for a certain place. And that's fine. That's good. And I'll tell you what else I never objected to. I never objected to people bringing in swatches of their fabrics. Oh my God, you should hear other gallery dealers talk about people who did that. I mean, it was just terrible. I thought it was great. I wanted my paintings that I sold to look fabulous. And so I understood people who brought in swatches of their couches or their rugs or whatever. You know, what a lot of people don't realize is that from the minute you wake up in the morning, you're a salt. People say, I don't know anything about art, or I don't know anything about design. From the minute they wake up in the morning, they're assaulted with art and design. When they get in the car and they see the front of the car with circles and lines and dots and patterns, that's art, it's design. And so people who say, oh, I don't know anything about art, everybody knows something about art. When a man picks out the tie he's gonna put on in the morning, or it's just so many things that people are picking out, colors and designs and art. It's the way I see it.
Well, Arlene, expand a little bit on this, because I think it's an interesting aspect of how you and Harold collected. And as I understand it, you never needed Harold's approval, and he never needed your approval.
That's right.
In collecting as a couple. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, there's his towels and her towels and and our towels, and I think that's the way. Harold liked some things that I just did not like. But I lived with a couple of them, and certainly vice versa, and this is the way I think you grow. And it's true, I think, of a lot of things that couples have to share in life. And, gee, why should art be any different than the the man who's free to pick out the color of his car. So I just think that it's great if they don't have to agree on everything. Interestingly enough, the artist that I had that people really seriously quarreled about, to the point where sometimes it got embarrassing, was Mike Russo. It was often the woman who wanted the nude and didn't mind the pubic hair being so blatant. And it was the man who was nervous. And I had more arguments over Mike Russo's paintings than any other artist in the gallery. So.
Mike has had a huge influence on you, and you talk about him and the way he talks about art and articulated art. Tell us a little more.
Did many of you know Mike Russo in the audience? Okay, you know how eloquent he was. I walked into art school as an adult and thought, what am I doing here? All these kids, you know, they were 18 years old and here I was. And I really almost started to walk out, but somebody said, you know, are you new here? I said, yes. And they said, I'll show you where to go. And my first class was Mike Russo's art history class. And he was so eloquent and it was so enlightening for me. And I just walked in and it didn't matter that the rest of the class were 17 and 18 year olds. My whole life started walking into that class. Something happened and I would only hope that everybody in this room would have some of that experience when they saw a painting or a sculpture or a watercolor or print and fell in love with art.
And this one is always, I think, something for us to admire. You know, Arlene, when you talk to her, and I want her to expand a little bit on this, she always quotes her mother. She always had great quotes, and that's Helen Director. And sort of words of wisdom, Arlene, that she gave you, that you've passed on to, I think, us mm-hmm. and me and this institution. Share a little bit of some of your reflections.
I was really, really fortunate. I had a mother who was born in Europe, in Poland, and came to this country as a little girl, was very, very poor. And as a young girl, she and her brother worked in a factory in New York. She never used the expression, but I'm sure it's what we call sweatshops. And he made ties, and she worked in a factory that made paper flowers. And she said if they made their quota, they got to keep an extra one that they made, and that after work, long hours, she would go out in the street, and she said she thinks that people felt sorry for her because she was so little. She was a small woman, and they'd always buy her flowers from her. And the one thing relevant, nothing to do with art, but having to do with my mother, which had a lot to do with me, was she always told me, there's no shame in being poor, but there's shame in being dirty. And she just was one heck of a woman, and she just was a wonderful woman. She worked side by side with my dad, building up a big business. She always worked. She was the one that, through the Depression, saved the pennies and the dimes and the nickels so that they could come to Portland. This was in Salem, where I was born, so that they could come to Portland and have enough money to buy a furniture store, which is what they did. And this was due to my mother. And she was a fabulous role model, a wonderful example. She was unusual in that everything she learned, she wasn't taught, she learned by herself. She was always ashamed of her handwriting because she was basically left-handed, but when she went to school as a little girl in New York, they used to hit your hand with a ruler to make you write with your right hand. And she was just a wonderful woman. She did build up this business with my dad, and she retired. And it really bothered me because I saw this role model for me, this active, dynamic woman who ran a big business, and all of a sudden, in retirement, I saw her make a project out of small things. So when I decided to open a gallery, I said, how would you like to be my partner? And she was so smart. She taught me things. And one thing in particular, once in a while, a customer would come in and my mother would say, don't take credit from that person, because that was the way you sold art then. You sold on credit. And I'd say, Mother, what do you mean? You're so suspicious. And she looked at me, and I've never forgotten it. And she said, when you've been in business as many years as I have, you'll be suspicious too. And guess what? She was right. But she was terrific, and I was very, very lucky. And Harold said he had the greatest mother-in-law in the whole world. So.
It's not only been a relationship to the artworks, but to the artists. And that's always been, I think, a unique aspect of what you've created here.
How many of you are familiar with Robert Colescott, the artist? Oh, great, good, okay. So Hilda and Carl told me, go meet Bob Colescott. So I ran down to Portland State, and I got in the wrong building and was late, and I was sure he'd left. And okay, and I met him, and first of all, they wonder, who is this person? What does she know about art, and what's she doing opening a gallery? I mean, I had to really prove myself, because they just really thought I was an upstart. I was. And so I went down to Salem the next day to the Busch Barn to see this glorious show. And I mean, what a great painter. So I had Bob in my gallery for many years. We were good friends. And then Bob left and went to Egypt to teach the American University in Egypt. And Harold and I were in Paris when Bob and his wife at that time, Sally, had to flee Egypt. And I mean flee. And she was a potter, and she had to leave her kilns and everything behind. And we met Bob and Sally in Paris. And we met him for lunch. And I looked at Bob and I said, oh my, and he'd grown a mustache. And I said, my God, Bob, you look, Maury, we had just come from Egypt, but not in the same place where Bob, we couldn't connect there. And I said, Bob, my God, you look more Egyptian than the Egyptians. And fast forward several years, and how many of you knew Bob early in his career? Okay. He was not a black artist. Am I right? Okay. He was not a black artist. What happened was that when he went to Egypt, he told me later, it was like he came home. He felt at one, and he called it Africa. He didn't call it Egypt. Of course, Egypt isn't Africa. And I said, Bob, what happened? And I have pictures. I swear to you, I have pictures, and people will back me up, that the years that he was at Portland State and that I had him in my gallery, he was not black. And once he came out, I have pictures, his features, everything. Brilliant, brilliant artist. He represented America, Venice Biennale, as Brian said, and a wonderful, wonderful person. He since has died. And brilliant painter, but it was one of the most remarkable things in my whole gallery life. And I felt privileged to know him as a person and as a friend, and I am a friend of his last wife. He was married several times, and her name is Jandva, and she is black, and she represents black artists. But it was a fascinating, he told me that he has a brother whose name is Warrington Colescott, who's a printmaker back east. But Bob said to me, my mother, he was from Oakland, always said, if you can pass, you pass. You'll never get a job teaching. He was light enough. And she said the same thing to his brother. And this is what happened in our society in those years. And if this is making anybody uncomfortable, I'm sorry, but it is such a part of my history with the gallery and with Bob Colescott. And the interesting thing was that we owned a hotel in Berkeley at that time, and the publisher of the Oakland paper was black, and he had an absolutely gorgeous wife who was black, and they had a, and she was president of the symphony, and the symphony had been closed down because of the union and everything, and so they had a big event at the hotel, and she stood up there, and she told this story that was absolutely almost identical to Bob's. How she grew up in Oakland, her father was a porter in Union Pacific, he was an accomplished violinist, but that was the only work he could get. And this whole story, and it was just like Bob, who also came from Oakland. But he finally came out as a black artist and was a brilliant, brilliant painter.
That's a great story, good story. Gregory Grenin, and you know, really a very symbolic of where we are today in this part of the country, but also a real national figure, collected by many institutions across the country. And you were right there at the beginning, Arlene.
At the very beginning, And do you remember John when he first came in from Detroit, and his things were laid out? Here's this big burly guy, and but I'll tell you just one really quick little story about Gregory. I used to work down at my gallery late at night, often doing my books, and particularly if Harold was out of town, it was a safe place for me to finish up stuff at the gallery. And so I had a discrepancy on Gregory's account on my books. So it was late at night, but I knew he was stayed up kind of late working. And so I called, and it rang and rang and rang, and finally there was an answer, and all I heard was, "Help, help, help." And I said, "Gregory, is that you?" And he said, "Yes." I get in the car, and that was when the gallery was on Morrison. And the one time I prayed for a cop to stop me, because I was going really, really fast. And it was right when car phones had just come out, and I was furious with Jordan because I thought he'd been so extravagant by putting a phone in my car, and I thought the only reason he put a phone in my car is because he wanted one. So, thank God. And I called to find out the closest hospital to where Gregory was, because I knew something was wrong. And I go, thank God the door was open. He is bleeding. Everything was drenched in blood. You know, when your adrenaline's going, I had the strength, this big guy, I got him into the car, how, I don't know, and raced to some hospital in the southeast, and they said, had I been 20 minutes later, he would have been dead. A skill saw, a round skill had flown off and hit him right here in his thigh. And I'm telling you, the blood was everywhere, including my car, and I didn't care. And so I really have a special, special bond with Gregory, and he, I think, with me. But, yeah.
And then Bob Arneson, again, another national figure who you immediately saw the talent there.
Yeah. My mother and I went to Mills College. He was an assistant to Anthony Prieto, right, who was considered one of probably the greatest American classic ceramicist. And Bob was his TA, his teaching assistant. And my mother was talking to Tony Prieto, and who I really went down to see if I could have things. And I was wandering around his studio, and I saw this young guy fashioning really crazy stuff. This is 1961, and just crazy. And he was darling and bubbling and wonderful personality. And I was so new to this whole game. I didn't know you didn't ask the master and his teaching assistant to be in the same gallery, let alone the same show when you open. And I just thought he was fabulous. And I just said, gee, how would you like to be in this show? I'm opening a gallery in Portland, Oregon. He said, I'd love it. And this is the piece he sent me. It was called She, Horse, and Daughter, Black Clay. And it was the very first thing I sold the day, my first day of the gallery, I sold it to Virginia Hazeltine, who is a noted collector of Northwest art. Her collection has gone to the University of Oregon Art Museum. And it just, you know, you couldn't, Harold used to say to me, are you a buyer or are you a dealer? Are you a collector or are you a dealer? The gallery was costing Harold and my dad, really, seriously. So, you know, I sold it to Virginia. And about 2 years ago, and I'd always wondered, 2 years ago, I'm at Nancy's restaurant, and I see Jim Hazeltine, and I said, gee, Jim, whatever happened to that piece that your mother bought from me the very first day I opened the gallery? It was a horse and a call. He said, as a matter of fact, I have it at a gallery in San Francisco for sale. And I said, you got to be kidding. I said, what are you asking for it? And he said, $25,000. I said, Jim, when vibrations get out in the air, somebody else is gonna want it right away. Please, can't we call right this minute to hold it? I want that piece. And I explained it was the very first piece that I'd sold and to his mother. And we got on the phone, they had it on hold for somebody, and he said it's sold, ship it back, and I bought it back 25 years later.
I looked at the collection, I was very impressed by that Indian beadwork, how beautiful it was. But it seemed almost to be not consistent with the rest of the work as far as a craft, yet it was so beautiful, it really fit in. So I was wondering if you could tell us if there's any special story about how you came about collecting that work.
There really is. I have bought Native American art for many years, but I was never really that much into beaded work. I always thought it was very beautiful. But one day, Rose Quintana, her daughter was born on Valentine's Day, Cecily, who now runs Quintana Galleries. I hope some people in here have been to Quintana's because it's a really wonderful gallery. And because her daughter was born on Valentine's Day, she used to buy a heart-shaped bag for her daughter every year, and she had this wonderful big collection. Fast forward, as many of us buy things for need later on, she had a need quite a few years later, but it was very important to her that the collection be kept together. She didn't want it piecemealed out or separated. So she called me and asked if I would please keep it together, would I be interested in buying it? And I understood what she meant about keeping a collection together and not letting it just get tossed out piecemeal by piece. So I bought the collection from her, and it's gorgeous, and I'm very proud of it, and I hope it's always kept together. It's a significant collection of heart-shaped beaded work of really covering quite a long period of plateau Native Americans.
Thank you. Well, thank you everyone for being here, and Arlene, and on behalf of this entire institution and this entire community, thank you for enriching our lives. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to my conversation. We, as well as countless others, are saddened by the news of Arlene's passing. As we are releasing this episode during the coronavirus pandemic, I want to thank everyone who has continued to show support to the museum and Northwest Film Center with your membership and your additional donations, and also by engaging with us on social media and experiencing our online content. On that note, this podcast is about to undergo some big changes, so be sure to hit subscribe. In the meantime, be safe, stay healthy, and we'll see you when the museum reopens.